Welcome to My Safety Tech Podcast with me, your host, Pete Thomas. Prakash, how are you?
I'm fantastic. Thanks, you, Peter. How are you?
I'm so good. Thank you so much for being on the podcast episode.
It's absolutely my pleasure. I've seen some of the stuff that you're putting out there and it really resonating with obviously a lot of people, but definitely resonating with me. So I'm absolutely pleased to be doing this.
Mate, honestly, you're too kind. You're too kind. And I saw your message about imposter syndrome this morning, and I was thinking, that's me. That shouldn't be you. You're actually doing this. I'm just sitting there pretending like I know what you're talking about.
I'm a civil engineer by background, right? So I'm not a safety professional. I'm not a tech professional. I'm in these two worlds where I probably shouldn't be, right? And so I do genuinely get imposter syndrome and suddenly now the CEO of a startup, right? I've never been a CEO of anything in my life. And so there's an imposter syndrome there. So I think like everywhere I look, I feel like, should I be here? Am I in the right place?
Yeah, no, mate, but I keep saying this in all of the interviews that I've had, and I don't know if you've had a chance to listen to some of them, but there's some really good ones coming up, and we've had this conversation so much that, look, health and safety is at this point now where it's been the same for probably around about a decade. You know, if we look at the, you know, one of the biggest outputs is the accidents and incidents, you know, the fatal accident statistics that are put out by the HSE, and they're, you know, around about 135 for the last year, 135 tragic accidents in the UK that have led to a fatality. And 7 years ago, they were exactly the same, 135, 140. So, you know, we've got to do something different. We've got to innovate, you know, and we're in a very moral organization. And sometimes I think it takes people like yourself from outside of the industry.
Yeah.
With your experience, your background, your innovation, your entrepreneurial drive to look in and go, do you know what, guys, I think you just need to tweak this, or I think I can make this process better or more efficient. And that's what's going to make the change.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I come from construction, and construction has got this kind of notorious reputation now for being the same as it's been for ages, right? Like, we build roads similar to what the Romans did. We build houses which is similar to what the Greeks built, you know, and there's this kind of external perception of construction that is archaic and not doing anything different. And some of that's borne out in the data, right? It's showing that productivity stagnated over the last 20 years or whatever. And so there's and then obviously health and safety has got a big impact in construction. And I think the two things almost go hand in hand, right? So there's a stagnation in productivity, there's a stagnation in safety. And I'm a huge proponent of, what I see is that technology potentially and digitalization potentially could help to move the needle, right? To have a step change in both safety performance and in productivity within construction and within the health and safety subset of that.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. So tell me about Navitech.
Yeah, so look, Navitech, I founded it, 3 or 4 years ago as a side hustle whilst I was in a corporate job with these massive construction consulting firms that I was working for. And essentially what I saw and the things that I was doing for these corporates was helping them to identify digital tools, deploy digital tools, implement them, track the efficacy in terms of how they are helping to improve productivity or safety or quality and all of these good things. And what I was seeing is that for whatever reason, as the construction industry was digitalizing, health and safety was kind of being left behind, right? It was almost always an afterthought. If there was a project management tool, it would go and do forms for quality. It would go and do risk management or something. And then like, oh, safety. Okay, we'll just tag it on. We can just create a form for safety. And so it was never really built for safety. And so we came up with this idea. And at the time, this kind of conversational interfaces were really coming to the fore, right? These chatbots and things that were coming forward. Actually, health and safety is almost like, it's got a lot to do with conversations. It's got a lot to do with people. And why don't we try and bring these two things together? And so it was really born out of that. It was born out of this kind of idea that the construction industry is digitalizing, but leaving safety behind. And then we had this idea to build this product to help conversationalize the way that we manage safety. But then we thought, okay, there are probably other aspects of construction that we could probably work on as well. So let's not just create a brand that that is focused on safety. So we created Narvatech as the group, as the company, and with a full intention of then having multiple products later on at some point in the future. But safety.ai, and spelled S-A-I-F-E-T-Y, was born as the brand for the product. So safety.ai is the product, Narvatech is the company. And what we essentially have kind of focused on now is that we're building conversational AI to help frontline workers to understand the risks and mitigate some of the hazards that we of the work that we're asking them to do. So typically, technology usually filters down to the workforce eventually, and it usually gets to them last. And they are probably the people that are going to make the biggest difference. So if you look in, and I'm talking about construction a lot, but this probably applies to many, many industries. But the frontline workforce, if you look at the demographics within an organization, are probably the fat end of the wedge, right? So if you can make a difference to them, you're going to make a huge difference to an organization or an industry as a whole. And so we're very much focused on applying AI, getting it as accessible and usable as possible to this frontline workforce, where A, they deserve to get access to the technology, and B, usually technology would get to them last or sometimes even pass them by.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. You can't see me, but I'm nodding away here frantically at everything that you're saying. And, you know, one of the first things that you said is that you look at the construction industry and the amount of innovation that's taking place, but health and safety just, it felt like almost like it was being left behind. And, you know, I was at London Build last year and I was looking around at some of the software and the tech that was available for construction. You know, everything from helmet worn cameras that build a three-dimensional model of the site. So as someone's walking around doing their inspection, it automatically records the site and then it turns that into a three-dimensional model to track progress, to track and monitor issues, etc. And you know, that can be shared obviously globally. It doesn't then require someone to come to site. And I looked at that and went, wow, you could use that for fire risk assessments.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see they just sort of looked and went, what are you on about? What is this industry? And it's like, yeah, you know, that industry where people are still walking around with clipboards. No, they're not. I'm just joking. Don't hate me on LinkedIn if you listen to this. But you know, we are a little bit far behind, you know, and it does feel like that, but it's coming. You can see it's coming. And that's why I set up the podcast. And that's why I've concentrated on my learning, because, you know, I've got another 20 years left in this industry, hopefully, and I don't want to get left behind.
Yeah, and absolutely. And I think the other thing is that we've definitely got lots to learn from the application of technology in other industries, in other functions. If you consider health and safety as a function, as a part of construction, which I consider to be an industry. But also, there's also, I think, nuances to the industry, nuances to health and safety, right? And I think the other thing, and someone I spend a lot of time talking to and I got a lot of time for, is someone called Ben Legg, and you should definitely get him onto this podcast.
Yeah.
We talk about safety not being a service that's delivered to the rest of the organization. It's an integral part of everything you do. So in the organizations I've worked for, like, safety is always, there's been a department for safety. So automatically you're creating this psychological segmentation that, okay, anything to do with safety falls onto this in this department, and they will handle it. Anything that goes wrong is their problem to sort out. Anything that they need to do with safety, they've got to do the initiatives. Whereas actually, safety should be, and I know it sounds cliche, but everyone's responsibility, right? Everyone should care that they themselves or the people that they're working with get home in the same way that they arrive. And so Ben and I, over the years, have really tried to make sure that we ingrain safety in everything that we do, right? So if you're designing something, think about safety. If you're project managing something, you think about how you can safely deliver this. If you're constructing something, you think about how you can safely construct it. If you're operating something, you think about how you can safely operate this thing. And so it shouldn't be this preserve of it. And I think some of the technology that we've built really starts to break those barriers down, right? And we're doing that in numerous ways, right? So we're trying to, A, make it as easy as possible to access information, access the technology itself by like taking away passwords and taking away usernames and that type of stuff. The other thing we're trying to do is break down the language barrier. And I think this is also something within safety that nobody really talks about, right? We all come from very different backgrounds, various levels of literacy, various cultural backgrounds, various different perceptions of risk. And that all relates to different understandings of risks and hazards and different understandings and perceptions of what we're being asked to do. And then you apply the language barrier over the top of it, and you're ending up in a real mess. So we're also trying to make sure that we break down the language barrier to try and reduce that friction as well. So it's all about reducing friction between people getting access to the information that they need and helping them to understand the risks and hazards of what we're asking them to do.
I'm going to interrupt this for 2 seconds just to tell you about a project. Now, I worked as a safety consultant for a long time, and I know how hard it is to get good quality leads, good clients. I set up a website and got literally no hits. The counter went to like 3 people, and I was embarrassed. It was embarrassing how much money I spent on it for no one to ever find it. It was on like page 10 of Google Ads, and I spent a fortune on advertising in trade publications and never got any feedback, thousands of pounds. And then I had to spend money on making the advert. So I've set up mysafetyconsultant.io. It's a place where you, the seller, can interact directly with your customer. And everyone's welcome. If you're a fire safety consultant, a fire extinguisher technician, fire door inspector, well-being specialist, or if you're a safety software company that sells software to business owners, you're welcome to advertise on mysafetyconsultant.io. Please give it a go. Thank you. Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And, you know, in the UK at the moment, we're going through some massive changes in building safety legislation, and particularly around fire and fire safety. And that's one of the specific areas that it's looking at, is how do you communicate information and instruction to residents in a residential flat block, for want of a better word, you know, a block of apartments or flats. How do you communicate that message if they all speak different languages? Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're very traditional. So we've got our fire safety signage that's got, you know, our fire action notices, and you'll have seen them like luminescent and blue and red colors next to exit doors in the UK. But, you know, you can't put that in 50, 60 different languages.
Yeah.
And you can't manage that without tech.
Yeah. Exactly. Absolutely. And the other thing as well is you think about just in your daily life, how you're getting information. Forget about whether it's information about fire or information about health and safety, but just generally, how are you getting information? A lot of that information is text-based and is coming to you via text-based applications, right? So just let's just take WhatsApp for an example, right? If you think about today, how much information did you receive through WhatsApp? Someone probably sent you a link to BBC News article. Someone sent you a link to Instagram where there's a video, or a TikTok or something like that. So we're already used to receiving information in all walks of life through this digital medium, right? Through the digital formats. And so what I think we need to do going forward is basically embrace that, right? It's obviously a medium that people are in tune to, people are used to, people find intuitive and easy to use. So we should be tapping into that.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, let's go on to it. Let's talk about large language models and safety. How difficult has that been to set up, and what is the ongoing challenge with using LLM for health and safety?
So I think the challenge with any technology, right, is that you can do some cool stuff with it, right? And for demonstrative purposes and things like that, you can do some great stuff. But, like, is it valuable, right? What can you get it to do to then actually add value to your work process or your day or your life? Like, what is? And so I guess the challenge for us has been is that this look and feels like great tech, right? It feels like it's great, but we really didn't want to get into a situation where we have a great solution going to look for a problem. We want to be solving problems, right? With the tech. And I think a lot of tech does suffer from that. You basically build the solution or buy the solution and then work out, okay, where am I going to apply it? Which problem am I going to solve with the solution? Whereas we should be doing it the other way around and saying, okay, I've got these problems. Like, what are the technological solutions that I can find or build or develop to be able to help me get over those pain points? And so that's been a challenge. Big challenge for us, and particularly because we picked kind of the intersection of two under-digitalized, the cross-section of two under-digitalized industries or disciplines with construction and safety, has been adoption. So the initial premise that we had when we first started was we wanted to get people off of WhatsApp groups. So on a lot of projects that I was working on in the Middle East, what we were seeing is these WhatsApp groups that were where the various different stakeholders of a project, for example, were sitting, and they were all exchanging information about observations that they were seeing, or if an incident happened, they were kind of trying to manage it through this very unstructured, messy stream, right? Where like lots of other things could get interjected and it's very hard to kind of follow through. I thought there's got to be a better way of doing this. And so we basically looked at creating this chatbot that sat on top of it, that helped you to structure it, help predict some of the answers to some of the questions that we were asking and things like that. And to try and say, okay, great, you love WhatsApp, but we're going to give you something that's better. But when we try to deploy it, what we're finding is that getting people off of WhatsApp is so difficult. When humans find a habit, it's really, really difficult to get them off of that habit. And so what we've done recently is then now gone to where people are. So we've gone to WhatsApp. So we kind of said, okay, all of our potential users are already on WhatsApp. Instead of trying to push water up a hill, let's go to them where they are. And then where it's appropriate, we'll pull them into this structured environment. So we'll deep link them into our application where it's appropriate. But for most things that we want to do, and in order for us to do what we wanted to do, which is kind of get the technology out to the people, get people understanding the risks and the hazards and that, we can do that in WhatsApp. And we're able to do that now because of how the technology is developed and moved on. So that's kind of like, those are some of the kind of challenges. The ongoing challenges, I guess, is keeping up the accuracy and stopping some of the hallucinations that you can get from LLMs. Obviously, and I don't want to sound too dramatic, but what we're dealing with is life and death. And so if the LLM is telling people something, they go and do it, and then something happens to them, that's a real big issue, right? So trying to make sure that we're being as accurate as possible, we're giving as appropriate and contextualized information as we possibly can, that's a challenge, and it's going to be a continual challenge for us.
Yeah, absolutely. So what I've heard this term before, actually, I interviewed James Pellett, and he told me about these hallucinations with LLMs. What are they? Because surely if, I don't know, it just sounds strange, because you can effectively train your own LLM, can't you? So it shouldn't have any other information go into it than what you've provided it. How does it hallucinate?
So that's what we've done, right? So we've taken an open source LLM and then fine tuned it so it can only talk about safety, right? The problem and the issue, it still not completely goes away, but it reduces significantly, right? To the point that where it becomes almost insignificant. You get issues with hallucinations when you've got large language models that are trained on everything, right? So when they're trained on the entire internet, for example, like OpenAI and some of these others, and then they basically access those raw, if you like, just unfiltered, without any guardrails on it at all, that's when you start getting hallucinations. And so the hallucinations come about because of the way that the large language model interprets what you say, right? Let me think of a good example. So, you know, some words have multiple meanings, and depending on the context of where you use them, right, that it changes the meaning massively, right? And so when you're talking to large language model, sometimes it will misunderstand the context of what you're saying and give you an answer back that's completely inappropriate. Sometimes it'll make shit up, right? So when you're talking to a large language model, because it's trained on everything on the internet, and if it doesn't know a certain portion of it, it will kind of interpolate between the two of them and then give you an answer, because its main function is to give you an answer. Its main function isn't to give you an accurate answer. Like there's lots of examples of this, right? There was this lawyer in the US, I think,
yes,
who used ChatGPT to basically build out his case, and then it just made up like historical cases, just made up references to historical cases, and he basically filed these things, and so that's a great example of a hallucination.
Yeah, absolutely, that makes sense. Okay, so just to summarize then where we're up to. So we've got safety AI. Safety AI is a large language model chatbot that you've managed to integrate into WhatsApp. That's amazing, yeah. Isn't it?
I think so. The WhatsApp is just a front end interface, right? The I guess the clever bit is the fine tuned large language model that we're able to do loads of different things with, and actually we can serve that into whatever interface within reason, but into whatever interface you want. So we've got our own application, and some organizations want that. They don't want people using WhatsApp and kind of are a little bit skittish and nervous about information leakage and things like that. So they want a controlled application that they own the data and they own the access rights to and things like that. We can pipe it through WhatsApp. Theoretically, we could pipe it into Teams. We could pipe it into Slack. We could pipe it into any conversational interface, right? We could pipe it into a chatbot that sits on your website, as an example. And we've got customers that are asking us to do this. So yeah, the WhatsApp thing has been bonkers, right? So we kind of like released it out, I don't know, what's it been, like 6 weeks or something like that. And the feedback has been phenomenal. The whole outreach, right? It feels like it struck a chord, right? And the reason that I think that it struck a chord is because you're able to see the practical applications of this technology now, right? It's no longer, there's this cool thing and yeah, okay, we can type it and it'll write me some Christmas card messages or birthday card messages, or it'll help me write this speech or something like that. Is that here you can see its direct application, how it can help us to communicate better around safety on construction sites. We removed the friction of people having to have passwords or usernames. Like almost everyone's got WhatsApp. I can't remember what the usage number is. There's 2 billion people, I think, globally that use WhatsApp every single day. So access to these people is phenomenal, right? And then the other thing that we can do is we can train our bot very, very quickly on your own information. Currently, we've trained it on like a corpus of information from the health and safety executive, from their website, so publicly available information. We've trained it on OSHA. We've trained it on EU OSHA. And so each of these is a different bot, if you like, right? It's a different model. And we can switch those models out within WhatsApp very, very quickly. So if, for example, yeah, Peter, you find yourself on the other side of the pond next week, and you're on a construction site or in an industrial environment where you want to know what OSHA has to say about, I don't know, working at height or about fire regulations, you'll be able to switch the model to then say, okay, only talk to me about OSHA, then, and it'll give you responses back that are contextualized to OSHA. And then on top of that, what we can do is we can train it on an organization's own safety management systems or their own documentation, which probably no one's ever read since the day that they were written, or when an auditor comes and you realize that you probably need to brush it off and change the date that it was reviewed on. And so we can really liberate that information and make it accessible through this LLM. So you're not only are you getting access to information that's from a regulatory body or from a government, you're getting access to the information that's contextualized to your own organization, the way your organization wants you to do work or wants you to manage safety. And I think that's really powerful. And that's something that's really struck a chord.
Wow, that's really interesting. So how long does it take to train an LLM then? Do you mind if I ask? And by the way, please say no, but is it OpenAI? Is it a ChatGPT sort of number that you've paid for as a license, or
no? So one thing we've been really conscious to do is not use OpenAI where we can, and we want to own the model. We want to own the model quality, right? So you could quite easily what we call pipe in OpenAI or some of these models, right, through an API, right? So you basically outsource your model inference and that to these companies. But what we've done is we've taken an open source model called Falcon, which was developed here in the UAE where we're based. So we're really proud to be a UAE based organization, kind of taking this technology out to the rest of the world. And so we host the model ourselves, and we've fine tuned it to talk about only about safety. So you can do this now. So if you went to our WhatsApp number, and I don't know how this is going to go out, but we can share the link out to everybody that's listening, and you can access the WhatsApp bot right now, right? Everybody can get access to it right now. And what we've done is that it won't talk to you about anything other than safety. So if you asked it, I don't know, what does Wayne Rooney do? It'll tell you, I can only tell you about safety. If you asked it like who Peter Thomas is, and it might come up actually because you're something to do with safety, but it probably will come back and say, I can only tell you about safety, right? So we host our own model. So, and this again is something that is striking a chord with our customer base, in that they are, a lot of people are nervous about sending information to Microsoft or to OpenAI because they don't know what they're doing with it. Whereas with us, you've got reassurance that that this data is staying with us. It's going to it's going into models that we control, or by association you control as the client that we're working with, and it's not being leaked and used to train models around the world, and you don't know where it goes into this black box. And so yeah, it takes quite a long time and quite a lot of money actually to host and train these models. It's not for the faint of heart.
Yeah, I think that's really reassuring actually, because you know, I'm going to be honest, I've used Safety AI. As soon as I saw it online, I thought, that's genius. Logged on, started asking questions straight away, thought it was brilliant. And then I started asking some really, really complicated questions, because you want to try this thing out, you know. And when ChatGPT came out, I was straight on ChatGPT, exactly the same. I was asking tons of questions of it. Yeah, you know, and I can understand how if I was to ask a safety question of ChatGPT, I wouldn't rely on it. There's no way I would be like that lawyer that went, oh, what are the control measures for this? Handy to give you a pointer in the right direction, ChatGPT, but I wouldn't rely on it. Whereas if something has been built and you've had some control over the level of quality of the information that's gone into the system, that makes it trustworthy. You know, that makes me a lot more comfortable.
Yeah, I was just going to say the trust is a big thing for us as well. So the other thing that we do, and I think we're doing this at the moment, we're uniquely doing this, and I'm sure others will catch on as well, is that we also give you the website or the document or where we got the answer from. So the model tells you the source of the information. So in all the answers that you get through our bot, at the bottom, it'll tell you the sources. And so let's say you're on the HSE model, it'll take you to the web page from the HSE website where it drew the answer from. So you can then go, and if you had any doubts, or you think that it's giving you bullshit, go to the link and go and check it for yourself. Or if you feel like you want more information, the information that's given you is too generic and you don't feel like it's right, go to the web. You can go to the source and have a look at it for yourself. And I think that's really, really important. And again, something that we've got some great feedback on is that because we're giving the source of the information where the answer came from, it's building that trust, it's building that reliability.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I can see that now. What questions did I ask? I've actually got it open in front of me. I'm not going to put you on the spot here, but yeah, I asked it some really nuanced questions. I'm always quite cynical and I'm quite difficult. Sorry, Prakash. Yeah. So I was like, how can I measure safety culture within my organization? Well, safety professionals could debate that all day long, but you know, it came up with a really long answer. And then you're absolutely right. At the bottom, it's got magnifying glass sources, and then it's got a list of all of the different HSE sources underneath. Yeah, and I've asked it a ton of other questions as well. And you're right, it does come up with a source. And to be honest, fair play. Yeah, fair play, because you're absolutely right about that trust piece. And I think, you know, It's not safety, and it's across all areas. People do have concerns about AI. You know, they read the newspaper, they have their concerns, and you know, and I even get it when I have a conversation about AI, and I think there's a lot of misunderstanding there. But if you've got something that will give you a summary and then give you a direction to the sources, well, it's much more reliable, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think, look, what we're trying to do, and we purposely call it a co-pilot, is you're the pilot. You're the person that's in charge. You're the person that's directing where we're going to go with this. This thing is there to help you when you need it, right? It is your co-pilot. Whenever you need to ask for his opinion or give you a direction or a steer in where you want to go. And so that's exactly what it should be seen as. It's not there to replace a health and safety manager's job. It's not there to replace a conversation that you would have with other safety professionals, but it is there to be this trusted source of information when you need it in your pocket. And that's genuinely what we want it to be. And you'll be able to talk to it in whatever language you want. So as an example, here in the Middle East, we get workers coming from all over the world. I'm mainly from the Indian subcontinent. So they and on the Indian subcontinent, they speak a plethora of different languages, right? Yes. And English is usually not one of them. And so imagine myself, I'm on a construction site. I see someone doing something that they probably shouldn't be doing, or just because there's a lack of understanding, or they're rushing to do something, and I'm trying to communicate and get them. I don't want them to just stop. I do want them to stop. I don't want them to just stop. I want them to understand what they were doing wrong, so the next time they don't do it, right? Or they understand the risk of what they were doing and how that might harm them. But I can't communicate because he doesn't speak English and I don't speak Hindi or Malayalam or whatever language he's speaking. So what we can do with our system is we can send it a voice note, right? So I can talk to the WhatsApp, send it a voice note in English. I set my output language to say Hindi, right? This guy speaks Hindi. And say, like, what are the risks with tying reinforcement? If that's the thing that he was doing, what the bot will do is it will send you back an answer in text in the language that you've set at your output, and it will send you back a voice note which you can then just play to him, right, or her, right, and then you'll instantly be able to communicate about this thing that you want him to stop doing, and I think that is immensely powerful. And we talked about this perception of risk really early on, and it's really interesting. So I travel to India quite a lot because a lot of my development team's there, right? And you look around people crossing the road, right? Just observing people crossing the road, and there, the people's perception of risk that this car's going to hit me, or the distance I need to stay away from this car to feel safe, is a lot shorter than my perception having grown up in the Western world, right? I was born and brought up in the UK and I want to keep my distance. But there, whether you're driving or you're walking in the street, the perception in their head about the distance that they need to keep to feel safe is much shorter than the perception I've got. Right. So I want to stay, I don't know, let's say 1 meter away. If I see an oncoming car, they will be literally a centimeter away, and that's enough for them. A centimeter means that it won't touch them and then they're safe. Like, whether you're in the car or you're walking. And that's a great example of the perception of risk, right? Their perception of risk about getting harmed by this vehicle coming is very different to my perception of risk because of my upbringing and some of my biases and all of the things that contribute to my perception of risk. And so these type of things, these nuances, I think is the things that we can start tackling through this technology.
Yeah, absolutely. And I still love the fact that it's through WhatsApp, because you're right, everybody uses it all the time. Yeah. And there are so many workplaces that use WhatsApp with WhatsApp groups on work phones. And it's just so easy, isn't it? You take a photo, you send a message, you send a video, you send a voice note. It makes perfect sense. But so with AI, when I started playing with ChatGPT, and sorry to say ChatGPT, that must be a bit annoying because you've spent so much time developing your own system. But when I started playing around with it, I realized very quickly that one of the biggest issues with ChatGPT, it's not the information that it has, it's the question that it's asked and how that question is phrased. And generally, the questions that I was putting in at first were quite poor. And I get the feeling that over time, this is something that we're going to learn to do, a bit like how we learned to send emails when they first come out, rather than going down the post office and buying a stamp. But how do you envisage this problem, and how do you think we can sort of get over this? Because ultimately, someone's going to have to ask this question of safety AI through WhatsApp. And if they're asking poor questions, then they may not get the right answer.
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of different angles to this, right? So let's tackle the first one about what you're talking about is creating correct prompts, right? This notion of prompt engineering, you heard different terms about it, and making sure that you're structuring the question that you're asking the ChatGPT to get something useful out of it. But that's not different to you structuring your Google search, right? So, and you've done this naturally over time, right? At the beginning, you would just type in one word, and because the body of information that Google had wasn't that huge, it meant that the first, second, or third thing was the most appropriate. But as the body of information that Google has now has gone massive, you do that same Google search and you get tons of information that's not appropriate, or someone's done a really good job at search engine optimization and forced their result up to the top of the page, and that's not the thing that you want. So now you're starting to type longer sentences or phrasing your Google searches differently. It's exactly the same here, right? It's you're going to have to learn to work with this technology in the same way that you've adapted on how you do Google searches and that. And I'm sure you're finding yourself kind of switching between ChatGPT and Google now, right? When you want to find certain things, there's certain things you go to ChatGPT for compared to Google. And I know I do that. So I think there's that. That's one thing, is that as over time, we will naturally get better at inputting prompts that give us the things that we need. And often, which I think you'll probably relate to as well, is you probably have to ask the question once, see what the answer comes out with, refine that same question or follow up with another question to refine that previous answer. And you end up with maybe three or four questions until you get something that resembles what you want. So what we're doing, what we're trying to do with that on through our technology is to try and approach it slightly differently, is trying to understand the reading level or the literacy level of the people that are asking those questions and allow them to set that. So if you look at some of the answers that are coming back, right, they're kind of set at a level where people, you're assuming that people have got a certain level of educational background, a certain level of literacy, and so we're assuming that they're going to ask a question with that same level of articulation, that same level of, what's the word, that same level of literacy, right? And then we're responding back to them with that same level of literacy. And for some of the frontline workers who are target audience, that's not going to work, right? Even if it's in their own language, if the response comes back to them in a language level that's made for, I don't know, masters or PhD students in from that country, then pointless, right? You're not communicating. You're saying stuff, but not communicating anything. And so I think that is also something that we're really conscious about and trying to work on how we can make it better. And linking that back to what you're saying, that not only applies to the responses, but also applies to the questions that people are asking. Is some people are going to ask questions that are going to be very simplified, right? Or people are going to type something really, really quickly. So we need to be able to contextualize and understand that. And obviously, I think it's slightly easier to do when we've got it compartmentalized and it's around safety, rather than trying to do everything, which what GPT and those guys are going to do. But it's still an issue.
Yeah, it makes sense. And I was thinking about, you know, and I still do it now, you know, when I Google something, like, say I want to bake a cake and I'll put in cake or something and it'll come up with cake for sale. And I'm like, no, how do I bake a cake? You know, and then it'll come up with all the different options. And I'm like, okay, no, I want a chocolate cake recipe. Do you know what I mean? So I think naturally you learn over time. By the way, I'm not that bad with tech, Prakash. I should I was just trying to give an example, but yeah, you know, yeah. And but you do though, don't you? And particularly when you start Googling for more complicated things, you can refine your answer if it doesn't give you quite the correct answer. And I think, you know, I think at the moment we're in this situation where people are asking AI, like a chatbot, for example, an AI chatbot, they're asking the wrong question just because they're not really sure. But I don't think it'll be long before people realize that you've got to be quite specific with the question.
Yeah. And look, this is something we've also like really trying to deal with internally as well. So I think that's also something that we're really conscious about, is showing people the value that they can get out of it, right? So like, for example, write me a toolbox talk for doing this piece of work. These are things that people don't immediately think about, because that's not what they've done in WhatsApp. That's not what they've done with interacting with ChatGPT or any of these things. So we need to almost educate people about how to use the tool. And I'm sure over time, there'll be uses for this tool that we haven't even thought of yet, right? As people start using more and more, and we'll see the application of it, and we'll see the value of it, and we'll find things that we never intended people to use it. There'll be people using it for things that we never intended it for.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. One of the things that I say about tech quite a lot is that we can only innovate to the point of which our imagination will allow us to think.
Mm-hmm.
And I see this quite a lot. Like, there was a video that someone had put online, and it was of a robot cutting wheat. So if you can imagine this, there's wheat planted in rows, and this robot is a humanoid robot, two legs, two arms, body, head, and a like a small hand size in one hand, cutting the wheat and tying it up in a bow. And I was like, if that's all our imagination will allow us to see, we're not going to go very far, because if you have access to all of the innovation, all of the tech in the world, and you can't think of a different process from when the seed is planted to when the wheat ends up on someone's table. So, you know, even with my limited imagination, I could see a situation where you have like a large conveyor belt of effectively ground.
Yeah.
I'm clearly no farmer, but and the seed is planted as it moves, and then, you know, rather than something walking along to cut and to sort of cut the wheat, you know, the ground actually moves along. And then I was like, and then you could make that vertical, because then you wouldn't be you wouldn't have the restriction of like acreage to grow food, you know, but obviously you'd have to have light. But do you know what I mean? Just this concept, we would go, okay, well, there's a human. Let's make a robot version of a human to do all the stuff that we're already doing utterly inefficiently.
That is an amazing point, right? And I've never heard it articulated so well.
You're being too kind.
No, honestly, so look, one of my pet peeves is now when we go from manual processes, let's say form filling, right? All we do is create digital versions of those manual forms, right? We don't use that opportunity to look at whether it's still appropriate or was something done because it had to be done this way because of the way that we were doing it manually on a paper-based form. No, we just, this was the form. These were the questions that we asked. Let's just turn that into a digital form. So now all you're doing, right, is basically turning an inefficient process that was done on paper into an inefficient process that's now just done digitally. Yes, okay, you can capture the data more efficiently and be able to put that into a database and analyze it and all of those things. Whereas if it was on paper, someone would have to turn that into digital, put it into a database, and then you can do the analytics, right? So you maybe reduce one step, but you haven't done anything different. It's because all you've done is use the technology to mimic the thing that you were doing manually in the same way that you described this robot picking wheat, because it's just mimicking the way that a human's done it. And I think that is a great way of thinking about how we should be looking at technology to change the way that we do things and change the processes. And that's exactly one of the drivers for us doing this, right? So one of the kind of early products that we had was to conversationalize workflows. So instead of turning forms into digital forms, what we were doing is we were trying to turn forms into conversations, and so that we can make them as efficient as possible to capture this information. And that way, we not only capture information that's limited to what the form is asking us to capture, we could potentially capture other useful information and infer more information from people naturally talking about what it was, right? Let's take an observation, for example. An observation is typically like, where were you? What happened? What did you observe? Blah, 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 right? It's a set of questions that you'd ask. But if you ask somebody, right, what did you observe? And they said that they tell you a sentence, then you, or as the AI, then extracts, okay, this is where it was. This is what time it happened. This is who was there. This is what actually happened. This is what some of the risks might be. And you're able to then infer a lot more from like a sentence or a paragraph than just asking something in a linear fashion. And that's just one example. The other thing, and I think this, we were just talking about this before we came online, is changing something that's manual into something that's a little bit more efficient to do in a digital format actually potentially could be a bad thing. And a lot of people don't really think about this, right? So one of the things that I used to do as a digital practitioner is do this thing called the implementation of BIM, right? Building information modeling. It's this process of managing data, controlling data through a construction lifecycle, and it revolves around doing stuff in 3D. And what BIM allowed people to do was it allowed people to do this thing called clash detection. So you could take a design, and because the design's done in 3D, you could get the computer to find all the places where something clashes with something else. So if a pipe clashes with a wall, if a pipe clashes with a air conditioning duct, if it's going through a roof or a ceiling without a cutout, and it will identify all of the clashes for you. Now, in the traditional way of doing it, someone would have to manually see that and have a look at it and fix it. And I don't know, let's just say you might find 300 of them. Doing it this automated way, you end up finding 30,000 of these clashes. And so you spend all your time trying to resolve these clashes, and some of them are inconsequential and insignificant. But because this digital tool now gave you this avalanche of information, you basically got distracted by it, right? And you can't get the signal for the noise. You ended up with so much noise that you can't find what's actually important and have to prioritize. And I think there's definitely a risk as we digitalize things. We have to be really careful, we have to be really careful with not creating digital noise.
Yeah, absolutely. And I keep saying this as well with a lot of software systems is that, you know, we're going to end up with this system of sort of garbage in, garbage out. You know, we've got so much junk data that we've collated, safety accidents and incidents. You know, we'll collect data for accidents and incidents because we've downloaded, you know, like an accident incident template off the internet, and it just happens to have 30 boxes of information that we need to collect. And so we've just collated those 30 boxes of information, and we've done that for the last 3 years. And then you look at it and you're like, did I really need to know that? And one of the things that I always comment on this podcast is that, you know, I saw one once that was recording humidity levels in a retailer. You know, it's like, oh, she fell over. What was the humidity level like on the shop floor? It's, you know, perhaps that's relevant for pharmaceutical or a lab or something, but it's not relevant for a slip on a shop floor, you know, not in the UK anyway. It's not gonna be that humid that the floor's wet. I don't know. But my point is that, you know, this just, we'd be better off cutting down and recording sort of like five key points, like five critical areas in greater detail, and getting rid of the other, you know, 24 sort of metrics that we've been sitting there trying to measure. Because the issue that I sometimes feel that we have is that, you know, we'll say like Microsoft Copilot, when people can afford the license for it. That was just a joke. It's not that expensive, but I believe it gets expensive if you've got a big organization. But, you know, and we'll put that into our system. But if our system's full of junk, and this is exactly what we were talking about as to why you've gone with Falcon, why you've set up your own large language model and why you've trained it, because you've got control of the information in there. But I think with a lot of companies, they're just going to plug an AI assistant into a ton of junk data that's just been collated over the last 20 years. And it's just not going to give them the answers that they want, you know?
No, absolutely. And look, I've got Microsoft Copilot, and I don't mean to be slagging it off, but I think that they've kind of restricted some of the features, or they're going to drip feed the features out. Cause at the moment, like I'm paying for it and using it, and honestly, I'm really disappointed. It doesn't do half the things I would want it to do or expect it to do. And I think that is part of it is down to what you said, right? They don't want to unleash it on the whole thing, and then people get crap results out of it, and then they basically become disheartened with it and never come back to it. So I think they're doing it really, really carefully and really with a measured approach.
Yeah, that makes sense. But I can just see this. I mean, will we ever get to a point with, say, for instance, safety AI, where someone could take a photograph or a video of a potential unsafe situation or unsafe act, and a large language model could understand and interpret that photograph?
But you can do that now in my WhatsApp bot. So if you paid for the premium feature and took a picture and said, what risks do you see here? It'll describe what it sees and give you some risks. At the moment, admittedly, it's a bit generic, but we're working with a few universities to basically create our own what's called a vision learning model, and not only to give you what risk it sees, but also to give you what mitigation measures you can put in place to stop that risk turning into a hazard. And that's available now. You can do that now. That's not something in the future. There's other technology that allow you to do that from a video. So there's a technology called Field. I always forget how to spell it. FYLD or FLYD on one of the ways around. And what that lets you do is in the morning, you can take a video of the work that you're going to be doing, talk about the work that you're going to be doing, and it'll create you a point of work risk assessment based on what it sees and what it hears you saying. So it's multimodal. So this is tech that's available today. This is not sometime in the future. This is stuff that you can use today. Yeah. So these large language models are now going multimodal. And what multimodal means that is that you can interact with them both to and from in text, in voice, and in pictorial or video.
That's amazing.
That's why it's so exciting to be in this space at the moment, right? It's kind of like, and again, you talked about imposter syndrome or whatever. It's genuinely, I feel like I've just landed in the right place at the right time. Do you know what I mean? And the tech's moving so quickly, that the evolution is moving so quickly. I don't know if you saw OpenAI this morning just announced their ability to be able to create 10-second video clips just from sending a prompt, right? So you could say, I want to create a video of, I don't know, a snowman on top of a mountain or something like that, and it'll create you a high quality video clip of that. They haven't released it to the public, but yeah, it's just coming out of their research. But that this and that is built upon the original large language model, which, if you think about it, only came out just over a year ago, right? 14 months ago, whatever, they released it to the public. So the pace of change in this area is just phenomenal.
How far do you think it's going to go? I mean, obviously without releasing any secrets, but how far are you, what are the plans have you got for safety AI?
We've got some big plans. Like, firstly, I think what we want to do is make sure that the message gets out to as many people as possible. And so that's why I really appreciate things like this and you giving me this platform to talk to people. I think part of this is education. Like I mentioned before, is educating people about the power of this technology and getting access to it is really, really simple. It's not that expensive, and it's not that difficult to do. I think some of the things that we want to start doing is like this, is to start creating content on the fly, right? So one of the things we're experimenting with, and it's not currently available through our platform, is that you'll be able to say, create me a toolbox talk on working on a scaffold, and then say, it'll give me the text. Okay, now can you turn this into a video? And so then the AI then takes that, turns that into a video, an avatar of the person that you've chosen comes up, and it will speak what the text is to you. So you've not only got the content generated by the text-based content generated by AI, you've got this visual representation of that text generated. And so you can see a person talking to you and telling you about this toolbox talk. And you can do that on the fly, right? So imagine, like, tomorrow I know my team's going to be doing this risky exercise. I'll get the AI to write me a briefing or a toolbox talk or a piece of training. And instead of you having to record yourself doing it or find a recording from the internet, you can get something that's specific and contextualized to your organization, to your work site, to the specific tasks that they're going to be doing. And then you can send that out to them in the morning, right? It'll be ready. It'll take, at the moment, it takes about 10 minutes to render these videos. And then you can send it out to them. So that I think is some of the real powerful things that we can start doing. So we can get to be really individualized with the training that we're giving people, or giving people to access, right? At the moment, health and safety training is really generic and it's not really appropriate for the masses. In the same way, like, medicine is moving to be really personalized. So like medicine, soon you'll be able to get medicine that's exactly works for your genome, for your gut biome and things like that. We can start looking at creating content around safety that's specific to you personally, where you're from, where you're working, who you work for, like what your literacy level is, all of those things. For me, that's where we want to get to.
Amazing. And I'm, you know, I guess I've got one more question, really, is that I'm on this sort of journey of improving my digital literacy. And you said you've come from, you know, an engineering construction background. Have you got any sort of tips for me or anyone listening who's a safety professional and who wants to develop, who wants to learn more about tech? You know, because it can all seem a little bit daunting at times, but with the speed of which we're moving, where do we start?
So, top tip is to follow Peter Thomas on all of his socials, right? So you can learn so much.
That's too kind.
Just generally, I think it takes a level of curiosity and maintaining that curiosity. People often forget that. So be curious, right? Constantly be thinking about, could I be doing this better? Or how is somebody else doing something that I'm doing? Or what's happening here? And being plugged into, all joking aside, some of the stuff that you're doing, some of the groups that you're creating is fantastic. Like, honestly, hats off to you for bringing these people together and having the foresight and the gumption and the motivation to do these things, right? So get yourself involved in some of these groups, whether that's on LinkedIn. I'm not on any other socials, so I don't know. There must be stuff on Insta and on TikTok and stuff like that. But get yourself associated with some of these communities that are discussing these things. I think that's a great way of learning. And then, yeah, just keep reading stuff. I think what you're going to find now is going to see more and more technology and how it can be adapted to different use cases and things like that. And if you're in these communities and in these forums and that, you're naturally going to see some of these stuff cropping up, and it's going to crop up more and more.
Honestly, thank you so much. Genuinely, thank you so much. And all the best with this with safety AI. It's incredible.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Take care. Bye-bye. If you enjoyed this episode, then please like and subscribe. It really does make a difference to the show. Thank you so much, and see you in the next episode.